Welcome to the special Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. First up on today's show, we'll hear about the secrets of maintaining a healthy, interesting, and romance-filled long-term relationship. Psychotherapist and relationship counselor Esther Perel joined me in 2014 to discuss all of this, something that she covered in her book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Excellence. The book provides readers with advice on sustaining sexual excitement in a romantic partnership. Perel debunks many myths surrounding both the male and female libido and sheds light on some of the hang-ups and rituals that often mar sexual encounters with our significant others. Let's take a listen. Do you think marriage or long-term committed relationships is harmful to desire?
Look, for most of history, desire had very little to do with marriage. We married for economic reasons. We married for companionship, economic support, children, social respectability. Then we brought love to marriage. Then we brought sexuality to love. Then we brought happiness down from the heaven, and it no longer is a privilege of the afterlife. It is a mandate that we need to accomplish. And then we linked marital happiness with sexual satisfaction. So we have revolutionized marriage when it comes to sexuality. This is the first time in the history of humankind that we don't just have marital sex for procreation because we want 10 children. It is the first time in the West where sexuality is not a marital duty of women. And it is all rooted in desire. It is connected to the individualism of our society in which we own the wanting, that's the definition of desire, and in which we want to have an erotic connection for pleasure and intimacy with a partner just because we feel like it. So how do we sustain desire in long-term relationships is a first. It is not a question that we have asked for most of the history of marriage. And then what happens is that we're trying to reconcile within marriage, to reconcile love and desire, to reconcile intimacy and sexuality. It's about bringing together two sets of fundamental human needs, our need for security and safety and predictability, and our equally strong need for passion and novelty and mystery and the unknown. And those two needs actually pull us in different directions and spring from different sources. But we are for the first time wanting to experience with the same partner anchor and waves, comfort and edge, security and excitement, predictability and surprise. And we take it for granted that this is a model that should be in the reach of all. And yet it is the grand experiment that we are in at this time.
But it's really asking two different things, as you say, with the sense of love and commitment comes closeness. But you say the desire needs a kind of distance. So it's this very sort of strange, almost like tension or dance between these two, what feel like poles.
Absolutely. You have the word. It's a dance. It's a careful calibration, it's a dialectic, it's not an opposition. But if we would say that love is about having, we could say that desire is about wanting. If love seeks closeness, desire needs a certain emotional and psychological space to thrive. If love wants to close the gap, desire is about opening that gap again and bringing it back to life. And when I ask people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner, not just sexually attracted, but drawn to in the broad sense, worldwide, mating in captivity is translated in 25 languages.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Been around, and it's extraordinary how the same answers are provided all the time. Number one is when I see my partner passionate about something, in their element, doing something they really like, radiant, playful, confident. It can be on ski, on surf, on stage with the kids, but it is when they are in their element and I'm looking at my partner from a certain distance, a comfortable distance, not too far because then I can't see them anymore, and not too close because then I can't see them either. But at a comfortable distance that allows you to see the otherness, the uniqueness of your partner, who after all these years still remains somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, a person with whom you can still, about whom you can still discover something. So people in their answer are de facto speaking about that need for an emotional distance between me and the other lies the erotic elan, lies the ability for the movement of desire that wants to reach out to someone and bring them closer to us or go toward them. And then they talk about surprise. They talk about novelty. They talk about, even when they say, when I see my partner vulnerable, it's because that's the part of their partner that they don't typically see. It's when I get a glimpse at something that isn't available to me on a daily basis. It's when we laugh, when we play, when we are carefree and unself-conscious, which is also on the side of desire. And these various answers imply that if closeness is part of love, desire needs a certain space to thrive. It needs otherness. It needs difference. It needs a bridge to cross with somebody to visit on the other side.
But I think that's so different from the way I think many people believe or feel, which is that if you know someone and they know you so intimately and you feel so safe, then that can be a place for this erotic desire or these erotic fantasies. But you're saying something really different from that.
It is true for many people, what you describe. For many people, love and desire are inseparable and inextricably related. But for others, they are also much more separate. My book started because people would come into my office for this very question. We love each other very much. We have no sex, they would say. Love and desire, they relate, but they also sometimes conflict. Why is it that so often sex degrades, even in couples who continue to love each other as much as ever? Why is the forbidden? So I began to look at that sometimes the very elements that nurture love, protection, a feeling of responsibility toward the other, feeling of worry toward the well-being of the other, sense of mutuality, reciprocity, that all those elements that are so core to love are sometimes, paradoxically, the very ones that stifle desire, which is much more on the side of the unself-conscious, on the side of carefree. Responsibility and worry are completely anti-aphrodisiac. In the description of when I see my partner radiant, self-sufficient, doing his or her thing, you never have caretaking. It's a very powerful thing. Caretaking is really loving, but it sometimes is very much unerotic. There is something about that freedom of seeing my partner in his or her orbit, you know, without needing me, that allows me to then feel that I want them or that they can want me. It is the real switch between I need you versus I want you that is often at the core of where desire resides.
Well, I think
yes, I don't ask people how much the sex they have because people have had sex for centuries, especially women, and felt nothing.
Well, does that also help explain why people have affairs, whether even having an affair is sort of falling in love with yourself in a way?
You know, there are loads of reasons why people stray. But I think that one of the most important ones, because the majority of people I see are not repeat offenders, they're not philanderers, they are often people who have been faithful for decades and who one day cross a line that they never thought they would cross. And so one wonders, for a glimmer of what? Why would people risk losing their kids, their family, their house, their money, you know, for what? And women even more so. And then I began to think, to listen to hundreds of people that I will see and interview and work with telling me that it is not about sex. That is the big misunderstanding. It is about attention. It is about care. It is about feeling special and important and that we matter again. It is about reconnecting with lost parts of ourselves. And that often when we go elsewhere, it's not just that we want to leave the person that we are with as much as we want to leave who we have ourselves become.
Mm.
And there is longing for that reconnecting with a lost self that is often a part of the experience of an affair. But there's so much to say, you know, about why people go. But it is a piece of this that is often overlooked, that people feel that they are alive. I mean, that is the word that I would say worldwide I am hearing when I interview people about infidelity. People feel alive. they, you know, the same children are there as were there yesterday, but they managed to get energy to cross town and show up at 6 o'clock in the morning on the other side of town, because there is that. I have to have it. I'm energized again. It's that. An ultimate experience of eroticism, I would say it like that. And that has very little to do with sex. There may be emotional infidelities, and they will have that same kind of energy of once again feeling important and engaged.
Do you, Esther Perel, make a differentiation between men and desire and women desire?
There are plenty of differences and a lot more similarities. I think that the men have had throughout history the permission to pursue their erotic needs a lot more than women. And women, throughout history until today, have often put their security needs above their erotic needs. But that doesn't mean that they experience sexuality fundamentally that different of men. What is different is that they are often more willing to forego the whole thing. So it looks that women have less of a need in sex and women are less interested in sex in relationships. And I often think maybe they're not so much less interested in sex, but they're less interested in the sex that they're going to have. Mm. In order to want it, it needs to be worth wanting, and they don't always find that it's going to be worthy enough. It's not a good enough experience. So if I'm tired, I may just as well go to sleep. Now, on the one other hand, I would say female sexuality is a lot more subjective. It is full-bodied, and in that sense, it is much more contextual. She can lose it much sooner, but she actually also can reconnect with it much easier because it is all over her body and much more diffuse and related to her relationship and her feeling about herself. Ask every woman first about her own phylogenia. Would she make love with herself? If she does not like herself, if she does not like her body, if she does not want to stay inside her body, why would she invite anybody to come in there? On the other hand, I think that we often oversimplify male sexuality and think of it as a biological creature that is in perpetual motion, just looking for an outlet. And I think that men, no less than women, are driven internally in terms of their sexuality, their sense of self-esteem, their sense of depression, their sense of anxiety, their feelings about their accomplishments at work, their fear of rejection, their need for competency, their doubts about her pleasure. All of these are internal experiences that men have that also influence their sexuality.
I met my old lover.
We just heard my conversation with psychotherapist and relationship counselor Esther Perel. She joined me in 2014 to discuss her book Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Excellence. You're listening to the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about dating the second, third, and fourth time around. Stay with us.
Still crazy after all. I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize.
Welcome back to the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. Dating is hard. It requires making yourself vulnerable with the potential for rejection and heartbreak, something that can make dating later in life even more daunting. When you're in your 50s, 60s, and beyond, finding a companion can be a tricky thing to navigate. Last year, we talked about finding love the second, even third time around when we were joined by anthropologist Helen Fisher and sociologist Pepper Schwartz. We explored the do's and don'ts of romantic encounters later in life, as well as the appropriate way to handle the topic of dating with adult children. Let's take a listen. Well, let me start with you, Pepper Schwartz, because you have sort of lived what it is that we're talking about as an older person, to use your word there. Are you part of a trend, you think, of boomers that are interested in having some kind of active social life as they get older?
Oh, definitely. I'm sort of at the edge of it. My generation has been sort of inventing ourselves as we've gone along, and we've liked being young, and we're fighting to stay as young as we can. And That means that we don't think we're unworthy of embracing love again and again and again if necessary. So, yes, I do think, for all the hackneyed phrases that have been used, that the ages of 50, 60, 70, and whatever else we claim as we age are really different. And I think we feel an entitlement to life's passions that our parents and grandparents did not.
And Pepper, is this because people are living longer? Hopefully they are healthier as they age into their 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond?
I think that's absolutely true. Living healthier, living younger. You know, look at the way people in their 50s and 60s and 70s live now, in the sense that they share the same music, you know, many times with their kids. They share the same clothes. They haven't segregated themselves into old age. And so I think both in terms of the cohort, the people who grew up in the 50s and 60s are different than the people who grew up in the 20s and 30s, and also the fact that we can replace our knees, our hearts, you name it. We really can reclaim a vitality that makes us think, 60, we could live healthy for 30 more years. We don't want to do it alone, or we don't want to do it with the guy or the woman we've been doing it with. One of the interesting things is that the divorce rate has leveled off at every age except those people over 50.
Helen, to you, and this is sort of more broadly speaking, even beyond dating, but just sort of having an active social life as one gets older. I mean, the truth is, when you get older, friends die, family members die, people get sick. I mean, there are those kinds of losses. But is it psychologically and physically healthier to maintain a social life?
Oh, my goodness, yes. There's a great deal of data that, that isolated people have more diseases and die faster. I mean, we're a social animal. I mean, I'm an anthropologist, and for millions of years we grew up in these little hunting and gathering groups in which there was no privacy. Everybody traveled absolutely regularly with at least 25 other people and interacted sort of almost around the clock. I mean, that's the way the brain is built, the way the body is built. We're built to get the exercise, to get out, to be laughing with friends, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a great deal of data that is extremely healthy for you, as is sex as you get older. I mean, the old thing, use it or lose it, and older people are really looking for sex and love. As a matter of fact, I do this annual study with Match.com called Singles in America. We don't pull the match population. We pull the American population. It's a representative sample based on the U.S. Census. But anyway, one of the questions was, would you make a long-term commitment to somebody who had everything you were looking for, but you didn't find them sexually attractive? And the least likely to make a long-term commitment without sexual attraction and, in fact, without romantic love are people over 60. They want the same things that younger people want.
Should that surprise us, Pepper?
No, because I think the fact is that, they're not looking at this as companionable old age. They're looking at it as love and passion, and that requires something that distinguishes the relationship from mere friendship or, just sharing a kind of compromise for the rest of their life. And that's not this generation.
But right. As a matter of fact, it's the young who make more compromises, because people of reproductive age really have got to find somebody who will bear them healthy babies. And they may be madly in love with somebody from a different background, with less education, et cetera, but they will pick a person who is going to be a good reproductive partner. And, older people are unchained from that reproductive need, and so they're going to spend their years finding people that they like, hanging around with them, and falling in love with somebody who can really give them what they need, or they'll go out with just their friends and have a good time.
To you, Pepper Schwartz, and you, as I said, you're kind of living this. One of the things that I have noticed with some of my older friends is, and I've tried to put a moratorium on this, but I've not been very successful, is to not complain about the fact that we don't look like we're 27 years old anymore. But I'm thinking about sort of the dating scene and the focus on appearance and how you look and how your body looks. How do you suggest older people think about all of that?
Well, I think they should take some comfort that I don't think it's as critical as it was. I mean, these guys and these women are both not looking like they did at 25. And I think one of the worst myths about dating out there that inhibits both men and women is that somehow the other person's only expecting a 25-year-old. or for 40-year-olds, for that matter, I think women think much more critically about how they look than men actually look at them, and I think there's a good deal of data to support that. And I also think that while, yes, there are men who are looking for substantially younger women, it's true, nonetheless, that there is a great deal of a great many men who are looking for an age mate, you know, for somebody who shared the life that they've shared. So I think that goes with, you know, realizing that we don't have perfect bodies. That said, if you're on the dating market and you're very heavy or other kinds of non-cultural positions, you know, it might, you know, give you sort of a lower chance of finding a mate as easily. But it doesn't let that possibility go entirely. There's a lot of ways people find each other attractive, and that excludes, for some people, thinking that only a size 6 or 8 is beautiful.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because I was scribbling as you were writing, Pepper, you know, style, personality. There's so many ways, Helen Fisher, that someone can be attractive beyond just their whatever their appearance looks like.
No question about that. As a matter of fact, quite rapidly after you fall in love with somebody, you don't notice the things that you don't want to notice. It's called positive illusions. You overlook what you don't like about somebody and then focus on just what you do. But just back to Pepper's comment for a moment, which is always so great. But anyway, you know, in this Singles in America study that I do with Match, one of the times we asked people, you know, what they felt about their body appearance and everything, and the young are more critical of themselves than the old. The older you are, the less critical you are. I guess as if we settle into our skin, we see that this is only part of who we are, we make terms with that, and we go on to set ourselves in other ways. So it's the young who really actually suffer from problems with body image more than older people, or at least that's what our study says. But anyway, on to your question. Yes, there's many, many things that would make somebody attractive to you that has nothing to do with, you know, some sagging here and some bulging there.
To you, Helen Fisher, only because you've looked at chemistry as an anthropologist, is the sort of chemistry of sexual attraction or even falling in love, is that the same through the ages?
Apparently, we've put people in, I and my colleagues have put over 100 people into a brain scanner and studied the brain circuitry of romantic love, and it's just as powerful in your 50s and 60s. We put a lot of people in the machine who are in their 50s and 60s, and we showed exactly the same activity in brain regions linked with feelings of intense romantic love as among those who are very young. So this is a brain system like the fear system or the joy system or the surprise system. And you can feel joy at any age, and you can feel romantic love at any age. So there's every reason that older people, now that they aren't living with their grandchildren and have some money in their pocket and feel the freedom of it, this brain system is like a sleeping cat. It will just wake up at any time, and you can be just as goofy at age 65 when you're madly in love as when you're 25.
Pepper, is the dating scene, is it that much different for people in their, let's say, 50s, 60s, and 70s as it is for their children or their grandchildren?
I think it's better. You know, I mean, I think you bring, you know, it's dating is you bring a little bit wiser, a little bit more mature, a little bit more self-love to it. On the other hand, you haven't done it for a long time, and while it's not exactly like a bicycle, you put the bicycle away and 20 years later you remember it pretty quickly, it does come back to you, but you are different. And I think you may not be as savvy about what things to be aware of, to be beware of. I certainly spend a lot of time in my books about dating, not just encouraging people, but encouraging them to be smart about the very few people, but they're out there, who are wolfish about this and want to prey on people's passions. Yeah, you know, what I tell people is, you know, stop making this like a job interview, you know. And the longer list, I say my name for people who have a really long list of requirements of people is lonely, because you couldn't check off all the boxes and neither can they. You know, just try to see if there's any spark of interest there, and don't, you know, act like you're interviewing them for husband or wife at that moment. And I think, as Helen says quite rightly, a lot of people are so scared of silences and so nervous that they, you know, try and keep talking and fill in all the blanks. And I try and tell people, you know, some conversations that are interesting that are not going to be pressing buttons, because the fact is that when you're nervous, you may ask questions or seem like somebody you really aren't, you know, kind of back off and just see what they do with their life and how interesting they are about various subjects. It's dating, again, does take a little preparation, because you don't want to present this anxious and to some extent in brutal set of questions for somebody who might say, you know, I don't need this. I think it's pretty charming, but I could also see in a real life someone looking at that dialogue and saying, I'm out of here.
And what about talking about former spouse? Is that totally not the right thing to do, Pepper, on that first date?
How many times can I say don't do that?
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to have you say that, actually.
And same, I've got a lot of data on that, too. No age, at no age do people want to hear about somebody's ex.
Fair enough.
Not to all approach.
It brings out the worst part of you.
What is that?
It
brings out the worst part?
The worst part of you, like, you know, he done me wrong, she took my money. I mean, yuck.
And how about aches and pains? And things that don't work anymore. But it is interesting, you know, when you're 25 and you think of someone who's 66 and you think, oh, my God, they're so old. Then you get to be 66 and you think, well, that's not so old, Helen.
Well, I agree. The brain doesn't change. The body changes, but the brain doesn't change. And in many ways, there's new studies of intelligence, and older people are really much better at accumulating data and putting it into patterns and coming up with very wise decisions. So the brain doesn't need to deteriorate in any way. And certainly your interest can grow and grow and grow because you're not so focused on children or on your job, and you can now expand to express yourself in different ways. So honestly, I think people get more and more interesting as they age.
Helen, do you think older couples, and as you say, you know, having children isn't part of the configuration there, but that older couples are more sexually adventurous, or do we know that?
I mean, they're certainly going to probably spend more time at foreplay. They've got more time, they've got more experience, and they probably need more time to get themselves really ready to make love. So I would guess, and I don't know, Pepper, what do you say about that?
What do you think?
Well, I would say the only thing is, and I agree with everything that Helen said, is that women are often a little less inhibited. You know, it's kind of like, what the hell? so they're not as good, quite bound up by some of the you know, feelings of what they would have had when they were young. Now, the people who are young now are not the same people who are 60 who were young at that age. They have had a much more sexually liberated world to come in with more information. But nonetheless, you'd be surprised how inhibited and worried and fearful some of these younger people are. And the women who reach middle age and beyond go, they're a lot more secure. They understand their own sexuality a lot better.
I'm curious about the effect on the children, and we're talking adult children here, when their mom or dad starts dating again and they're in their 60s or 70s. Is there are there some things to be mindful of?
Oh, boy, this is a real hot button. I mean, there's some people who are literally filling out the forms at dating sites for their mother or their father, hoping that their parents will find the right person. And, of course, there's other children who just can't even conceive of the fact that their parents really, you know, that a parent needs another partner. And, of course, they've got some problems. I mean, they may be threatened that suddenly their inheritance will go the wrong direction. So it's complicated, and I would like to say that, I mean, it's person by person. I don't know if there's any basic pattern, but I do think it runs the gamut of people who are thrilled to see their parents with somebody new and those who are absolutely horrified.
And Pepper, how do you suggest someone introduce either the idea or the person to their adult children?
Well, I would say don't ask their permission. You're a grown-up. You owned it, right?
Yes,
you know,
right.
Don't be so worried about them. You know, just say, look, this is my life. I'm very excited and happy to put someone else in it, and I hope you will like them, and I'll introduce them, you know, at the right moment, but I'm doing this, and not let them put them in the parent role where they think they have the right to control it in a way that they would have balked hugely if you tried that after they were an adult.
And are older people, do they feel comfortable doing that, or do they do that default mode of, of asking permission of their children, Pepper.
I often find them doing the latter, and I think this is a very bad idea. So, you know, I would just say own your own adulthood and your sexuality and your right to have it. And, you know, tell your kids. And I think what you can do is reassure them that you're not going to, you know, spend, you know, every dime you have on this person. And if it gets serious, you can give them some reassurances that you're protecting their interests as well. Because often the bad feelings are kind of about that. Really. Uh-huh. I mean, if you weren't so materialistic, but it often is.
But what about, I mean, especially if there's, let's say, a divorce or a death in the family, one of the partners has died. To you, Helen Fisher, oftentimes, you know, children are mourning in their own schedule and may feel a kind of disconnect from their parent who might be ready to start dating again.
Well, that's right. And I mean, Pepper's got it right. Just own your own sexuality and don't ask for permission. I think that's a really, really smart thing. Just don't ask for permission. Go on, do your thing, be sweet and kind and keep them in the loop and lead your life.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you?
That was my conversation with sociologist Pepper Schwartz and anthropologist Helen Fisher about finding love later in life. You're listening to the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about breakthrough research in female sexual desire. Stay with us.
Yet I get a kick out of you. I get a kick every time I see you stand.
What a girl wants, what a girl needs, whatever makes me happy sets you free.
This is the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're about to listen back to a very adult conversation from the Radio Times archives about female sexual arousal, the myths, new research, and the differences between men and women and their preferences in bed. We were joined by Daniel Bergner, New York Times Magazine writer and author of What Do Women Want, and by Meredith Chivers. She's a clinical psychologist who researches sexual preference at Queen's University in Canada. Again, this conversation contains some material that may not be appropriate for young children. With that in mind, let's listen to my discussion. I doubt a book has ever been written with the title, What Do Men Want?
And
there's no mystery there, is there?
There may be more subtlety and mystery than we give men credit for, but for the moment anyway, the sort of fascinating set of questions surrounds, I think, women's sexuality, and that's why I went on this journey. And as you mentioned, one of the preconceptions that we've been living under has been this idea put forth most recently by evolutionary psychologists that while men are programmed genetically to spread their seed, their cheap, limitless seed, and thus to be promiscuous, that relatively speaking, women seek out one good man and are thus relatively well suited to monogamy. Well, science is giving us a new and I think ultimately empowering picture of women's sexuality.
And I do want to pick up on that. What is your particular interest in this subject matter?
So this is the second book I've written about desire. The Other Side of Desire was the first. And in the process of researching for that book, I sort of stumbled into the lab of Meredith Chivers, who's a fascinating Canadian researcher looking into women's sexuality. And spending time with her, I began to see kind of societal blinders coming off, assumptions being shaken. And in fact, she would later say, I, Meredith, feel like I'm shaking the foundations of the way we think about women's sexuality. Now, that could sound arrogant. I think in her case, it was quite accurate. And of course, I wanted to stay with her and with other scientists on that journey.
Well, I'm very happy to say that she joins us. Meredith Chivers joining us on Radio Times. She's a clinical psychologist, associate professor at Queen's University, where her work focuses on the treatment of sexual functioning problems, gender and sexual identity concerns, sexual addiction, and atypical sexual interests. And Meredith Chivers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you with us as well. And I was talking a bit with Daniel Berger, and I said as a kind of a joke to get the conversation started that I've never seen a book about what do men want. As someone who does research on sexuality, is it harder to try to understand female sexuality?
No, I don't think that it's harder to understand female sexuality. I think that the balance of research that has been done over, you know, say, the past three decades since Masters and Johnson, when I came on the scene, seemed to come from a perspective where male and female sexuality were seen as somewhat, you know, opposite sides of the same coin. And myself, along with many other influential researchers, were beginning to question that assumption and whether these models of sexual arousal and desire, models of sexual orientation, whether these models really fit to explain what we were observing with women's sexuality. And ultimately, you know, the research that I do, we're interested in understanding female sexuality from a woman's perspective.
Well, let me talk a bit about some of the research that you do, because first of all, it's a very interesting approach to try to understand female sexuality, having to do, I guess, with what their bodies are saying and what they are reporting. Can you describe, I guess, in the most basic terms, how your research works?
Absolutely. So we have what we call a sexual psychophysiology laboratory. And so what that means is we bring people into our lab, both women and men, and we measure their physical responses to sexual stimuli. So we use devices that measure changes in their genitals. So as women experience vulvar engorgement and vaginal lubrication, and as men experience penile erections, we measure these with devices, and we also ask these people to report how they're feeling in a number of ways. And they watch a variety of different kinds of sexual stimuli. So in my lab, we're interested in understanding how people's self-reported attractions map onto their responses in the laboratory. And so we would show people, for example, things that correspond with what they're sexually attracted to. So, for example, we'd have a lesbian woman come in and watch sexual films of women and men and see whether her patterns of response match her stated sexual attraction to women.
Well, and I guess in a nutshell, if I can say that, what you found with women was an interesting kind of disconnect between how their body was responding to these images and what they reported.
Absolutely. So when I started doing this research as a graduate student at Northwestern University, I was initially very interested in this question of how women's sexual orientation mapped onto their responses in the laboratory. And I have followed that line of research since the late 90s. And what we found is that sort of the most unusual group are heterosexual women, that among heterosexual women, they seem to show a pattern of physical response to a really broad array of sexual stimuli. So films depicting men, depicting women, whereas they report that they're feeling sexually aroused predominantly by the male stimuli. Women who are same-sex attracted, so for example, lesbian women, tend to show a pattern that seems to be more congruent with their stated sexual attraction. So that's sort of one piece of the puzzle. As I continued to do this research, it became apparent that this pattern fit with a broader finding in this field of sexual arousal research, where there seemed to be a lower agreement between the physical responses that women experienced in the laboratory and how turned on they reported that they felt. And so this agreement seemed to be lower than what we saw with men. And so I had conducted something called a meta-analysis, which is a quantitative review of the literature to begin to understand what factors might be at play. And what we found was really interesting that, like I said, on average, women tend to show this lower agreement between mind and body than men do. But we also saw tremendous variation among women in that mind-body agreement, which suggested that other factors were in play.
Well, let me get you back in on the conversation, Daniel Berger. As you were telling me even before we began this interview, it was Meredith Shivers' research that really got you interested in this issue of, I guess, desire and arousal.
Right. So it was Meredith's lab where my journey for this book really began, and it was with that gap between what women were saying, turn them on, versus what their bodies were saying. And certainly, as I think Meredith will emphasize, it's the idea is not that the body speaks entirely for desire, that the body speaks some absolute capital T truth of desire. But certainly what I was inferring from Meredith's research was that we were missing something as a culture. We were looking right past possible truths about women and desire. And so I then continued following Meredith's research closely with great fascination and branching out with other scientists and then interviewing scores of women. And what I kept coming up against was the realization that that old trope, that old idea, you know, male promiscuity, females relatively well suited to monogamy, really was, well, first of all, based on some quite flimsy evidence, I think, and circular reasoning when I went back to look at the original papers. And then when I saw the science that was being conducted by Meredith and others, I really thought assumptions were being turned upside down by science that's being conducted currently.
But are you saying that women are more like the stereotype of men than the stereotype of women?
Well, one, you know, some people have suggested to me that what the book communicates is that women are men, or men are women, or we're all human beings, and that may well...
Or this is a male fantasy
that,
of women,
well,
too.
That's, I suppose, right. The risk. There are two risks in my, as a man, writing this book. One is that this is some version, my concocted version of Girls Gone Wild, right? That's problem, potential problem number one. And the other is that I, as a man, am going to be sort of foolish or arrogant in proclaiming, being one more in a long line of men proclaiming about women's desire. I'm going to let go. This really, in as much as it may be a male fantasy, it's also a tremendous male fear. And I think that's that sort of the fragile male ego and the threat to men is significant. And I think ultimately informs that evolutionary psychology perspective that we were referring to earlier. The second issue, though, is serious, the man proclaiming on women's right. desire. And I hope that I've gotten past that simply by doing 8 years of intense listening in labs, listening to scientists, listening to everyday women.
Well, let me go back to you, Meredith Shivers. As someone that does this research, then how do you understand what appears to be a bit of a disconnect? You're showing these images to women and what they're reporting, I guess on they're using iPads or writing down, what they're reporting doesn't seem to connect with the bodily response they're having to these images.
So I think the unsatisfying answer at this point is that we don't understand exactly why there is this disconnect. But certainly the research that I'm conducting, that others are conducting, is trying to shed some light on what might be the factors that are at play in beginning to explain this this variability in the mind-body connection for women. So, you know, one perspective that I've written and others have written about is the possibility that the physiological responding is sort of an automatic protection of the body during sexual activity. And so when women see something that is sexual, so stimulus is processed very, very quickly, you know, below awareness, and this initiates a physiological response which leads to changes in the vagina that cause vaginal lubrication. And this physiological response, much like how, you know, we salivate when we smell food, we don't necessarily want to eat the food, and I'm sure there's vegetarians out there who will report salivating to the smell of bacon at times, but that it's, you know, it's all part of a physiological response to protect the body, you know, in the case of food, with swallowing and digestion, in the case of vaginal responding, perhaps to reduce the amount of injury and trauma if a woman is forced into penile vaginal intercourse. So that's one perspective, that this is, you know, this disconnect between mind and body is a sort of, from an evolutionary biology perspective, a protective mechanism.
Daniel, if I can just go back to you and something you were saying earlier, which was you wanted to challenge some of these evolutionary ideas about, you know, men sort of wandering the world, spreading their seed, women staying home and taking care of the children. Do you think, I mean, in certain ways, there's, I think, a bit of a truth to that because it has to do with survival. Yes? Survival of the human species.
Well, it's interesting. Does it have to do with survival? So many possible places to begin, but let's just begin with one obvious one. That theory, and it is a theory, is very comforting to me as a man and very soothing to society that half the population is sort of genetically predisposed, at least, to serve as a kind of social backbone or social glue to hold us all together. It's not at all clear, in fact, that paradigm, that dichotomy, is the most advantageous to our survival. In fact, there's strong research to indicate that female promiscuity might be most advantageous to survival for a couple of reasons. One, in our close primate ancestors, it masked paternity. That is, it made unclear who the father is and thus prevented infanticide by primate fathers. Mm. Another, that it might allow for more advantageous sperm and so healthier offspring, more likely to thrive. So you can construct these arguments in all kinds of ways. And it's important, I think, to look at, again, what current science is showing about patterns of desire, Meredith's research among that science, in order to sort of take the blinders off and get a closer look. Two things to just quickly point out, by way of some of many examples. I think one thing that Meredith's research certainly shows, as does research coming out of other labs, is that old idea that men are somehow more visual sexually is really, again, very comforting for me, but something we've got to let go of. And in a way, part of the package of that evolutionary psychology notion of male promiscuity.
Well, it's interesting. Now, Daniel Bergner talked about Girls Gone Wild. I was thinking of the HBO show Girls and even the popularity of 50 Shades of Grey. Do you think, Meredith, that women are sort of changing in their either expression, understanding, acceptance of their bodies and their sexuality?
I think there's absolutely a movement afoot whereby there is much more open dialogue for, you know, coming from women talking about openly about their sexual desires, their feelings, you know, demystifying their experiences of their genitals and, you know, trying to sort of reclaim what I think for a lot of women has felt like a separation from an aspect of their self that's incredibly important, their sexuality.
That was my 2013 conversation with Daniel Bergner, author of What Do Women Want, and clinical psychologist Meredith Shivers. And that wraps up the Valentine's Day edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. Thanks for joining us, and have a great Valentine's weekend.